Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict looks at the figures of two prominent 19th century priests and saints associated with the city of Turin during his Wednesday general audience. And Enslaved by Porn, we talk to a leading member of a church-sponsored anti-pornography initiative in the US who says that addiction to pornography has created a sexual tsunami that is destroying families, church and society. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figures of two prominent 19th century priests associated with the Italian city of Turin, Saints Leonard Murialdo and Joseph Cottolengo. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
As the year for priests draws to its conclusion and ahead of his upcoming pilgrimage to venerate the Shroud of Turin, on Wednesday in his general audience, Pope Benedict XVI held up the example of two priests native of the northern Italian city who, through their dedication and witness to charity, have been written on the rolls of the saints.
St. Leonard Murialdo, the founder of the Congregation of St. Joseph, devoted his life to the education and pastoral care of disadvantaged young people. He saw his priestly vocation as a gracious gift of God's love to be received with gratitude, joy, and love.
The second saint who lived through the turbulent years of the Napoleonic Wars was Saint Joseph Cottolengo, whom Pope Benedict described as an outstanding apostle of charity.
Early in his priesthood, after a dramatic encounter with human suffering, he founded the Little Home of Divine Providence, involving scores of people, priests, religious and laity alike, in a great charitable outreach which continues today.
Indeed, this Sunday, May 2nd, Pope Benedict XVI will personally visit this home on the outskirts of this industrial city. It will be his last appointment of the day after having prayed before the shroud and celebrated Mass with the faithful of the diocese. And before imparting his apostolic blessing, Pope Benedict XVI greeted pilgrims and visitors to the Vatican this Wednesday.
I offer most cordial welcome to the Communion of the Ejegesen from the Lutheran Church of Norway and from the Church of England. My warm greeting also goes to the group of Jewish leaders visiting the Vatican with the Pave the Way Foundation. I invoke Almighty God's blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Over 1.5 million pilgrims are flocking to the Italian city of Turin this spring to view the Turin Shroud, which is on public display for the first time in a decade. And one of those pilgrims will be Pope Benedict himself, who is due to view the Shroud, which is housed in the city's cathedral, during a visit to Turin this Sunday. The shroud is a piece of linen revered by many as Christ's burial cloth, although others maintain it is a medieval forgery. Measuring over 4 meters by 1 meter, the cloth bears the inexplicable image, reversed like a photographic negative, of a bearded crucified man. Scientists have long been at a loss to explain how this image was left on the cloth, and this enduring mystery helps to explain why the shroud continues to exert such a strong fascination with believers and skeptics alike. No other piece of cloth has ever been so studied, examined, debated, and revered. Among those pilgrims who flocked to Turin to take advantage of this rare public display of the shroud was Mark Gushkin, an historian and member of the British Society for the Turin Shroud, who has studied the cloth since 1994 and written 4 books about it. This was his second viewing of the shroud, and he spoke to me about his impressions.
Well, the first time was in 1998, and that was obviously very special, as all first times are. It was very emotional to actually be in front of this object that had been studying for many, many years. We knew it backwards because I was there with a group from Spain, actually, the first time. I think people just enjoyed the experience and felt this wonderful kind of presence of just being in front of this cloth. It was just a very, very special moment. The second time on this last occasion was also very special. It was different from the first time in the sense that in 2002, you know, the shroud had been through what's known as the restoration. The image looks much clearer. It was very special as well because I was with a group of people this time from the UK who hadn't seen it before, and they were all, again, very moved, as were most people who were there. Obviously, in Turin, among all the hundreds of thousands of people that go, then there are many skeptics as well who go to see it as another kind of object for different reasons, just to see what it is that people get so moved by and why people will cross the world. I mean, one of the group that came over with us had come from Malaysia, specifically just to see the shroud.
And what do the people that you met there in Turin say about the fact that Pope Benedict will be visiting the city this weekend to view the shroud in person? Among the people that were queuing there, were they quite excited about this? Were they commenting about this?
People who would come from outside, pilgrims who would come to see the cloth, especially the group that I was with from the UK, they were all very, very excited about it and think it was a great show of belief in what the shroud is and what it represents.
Now, can you explain how and why you first became fascinated by the shroud?
Okay, this goes back to when I was actually at school. I think I was 15 years old, and we were taken by the school. It was a Jesuit school in Leeds, in England. And we were taken by the school to a local cinema to see the documentary that came out in 1978, which was called The Silent Witness. That was David Rolfe's first film on it. And I just got really interested in it. But I actually started working on it in the early 1990s because I'm a historian and linguist of old languages by trade. And that was been my investigation and research routes into the shroud have all gone through the historical side of it. And strangely enough, since then, I've met David and, you know, he knows the story and he knows that he's responsible for my interest, let's say. And it was nice because when he made the second part or the updated version of the film just 2 years ago in 2008, then I actually took part in that, which was very nice.
But it's not just Christians who are fascinated by the shroud, is it? I mean, why is it such a crowd puller?
That's quite right. It's not just people who are within any denomination of a church who are fascinated by this. In fact, strangely enough, it's quite often the opposite to this, where especially in the early 20th century, there was a very, very strange turn of events that took place then when there was a well-known Jesuit, Herbert Thurston, who was publishing articles saying that it was a fake and couldn't be real. And at the same time, there was quite literally the same year, there was a self-declared atheist, a French scientist called Yves Delage, who was claiming that it was genuine and real. I think that today there are two sides to the shroud. There is obviously a very religious and spiritual side to it because of the image that's on it. But the scientific mystery as to how the image got onto the cloth and everything that surrounds it, its long and disputed history, all the different kinds of experiments that have been carried out on the cloth and the different results that have come out. I think that this has attracted people from all walks of life and all kinds of beliefs or lack of beliefs.
What about the results of the carbon dating tests in 1988? I mean, how did you react to that? Did that lead you at that time to question your belief in the shroud's authenticity?
Well, I suppose everybody at some point along the way must have thought that. I certainly did. But as we would say, there are so many. You know, if that was the only test that had been done on the cloth, then I suppose we would have just had to accept it. But it's just one test among many. And when there are so many other scientific and historical fields that point towards a first century origin, then I really think that it should be the people who say that it's medieval who try to explain why. It's not good enough just to say, but this dating experiment says it's medieval. Well, you have to be able to explain all of the other things that suggest that it's a much earlier cloth, and nobody has ever been able to do that. You know, I mean, that's what happens in other scientific disciplines. If carbon dating or any other, we have 9 different experiments that point us towards one date, and then one other one says, well, no, it's much later or much earlier. People tend to disregard that. It hasn't happened in this case because it's not a good story. You know, I mean, the carbon dating being infallible is really something that's been published in the sensationalist press more than anywhere else. Saying it's genuine is just not a good press story, whereas saying it's false is. You know, I've been contacted at times by reporters who will say, well, we'll put you on the front page of the magazine if you can tell us something strange or controversial about the shroud. You know, tell us that it's a figure of an alien or something like that. But if you're going to say it's genuine, then we won't even put you in the magazine. And reporters will often tell you that directly. And that's how it works. You know, they want a good story. And unfortunately, the cloth being genuine is not such a good story.
And what are the main reasons why you were always so convinced of its authenticity?
Because I think that it does have a history that can be shown that takes us way back. And also the fact, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that nobody has been able to explain or reproduce how the image got onto the cloth. And I think that's just a fundamental factor. You know, nobody has been able to prove that it's a fake. People have said it, and people have made many, many attempts to try and come up with something similar to what's on the cloth, and nobody has been able to, whether it's people trying to find out how the image got on there because they believe it's genuine, or more commonly, people who are convinced that it's false, and they're trying to show how. There have been, you know, even copies last year that have been made, but none of them have been able to reproduce all the characteristics and features and properties of the shroud image. And I think this very fact, I don't think it's proof, but I think it's certainly a...
Okay. Now, how, for you, does the shroud strengthen your faith as a Catholic, a Christian? What message does it transmit for you?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think there comes a point with the shroud where science and history can take us to a certain point. You know, as I often say, there was an American scientist who passed away 10 years ago now, who always used to say that there is no scientific test for Christness. He used to say as such. In other words, science will never be able to prove that this is genuine. But we are human, and it's very human to need something tangible for faith. I don't think faith is based on the shroud in any way. In fact, I'm convinced it isn't and shouldn't be. But I don't see anything wrong with it being a help in times of doubt. It's something that we can see. It's something that we can read about. It's something that's there. And I think that's very human to need something tangible at certain points. And I certainly wouldn't say that's a sign of weakness. I just think that that's, as I say, we're human and we all have moments of doubt. And this is something there that certainly with me and other people I know has helped maintain faith through those times.
You've written 4 books about the shroud, 2 in English and 2 in Spanish. What message or what themes were you trying to get across in those books?
They were mainly written from a historical point of view, because as I say, that is my own field. And I think that both history and science can take us to a certain point that looks at this image and says, okay, this is what we know. Everything points towards its being genuine, but there is a point after that where you have to leave both science, history behind you. And the last step, I think, is a step of faith in saying, well, I actually do believe that this is genuine. And that's the point of view that I've always taken in my books and articles. Not that science will prove it's genuine, but there comes a point where that last step, I think, is always going to be a step of faith.
I was speaking to Mark Gushkin, historian and author of 4 books about the Turin Shroud. The growing scourge of addiction to pornography has created a sexual tsunami that is destroying men, families, church and society. That's the belief of Dan Spencer, a Catholic speaker on sexual integrity who helped set up an anti-pornography initiative in the Archdiocese of Kansas City in the US state of Kansas. Spencer says pornographic addiction is so prevalent that more than 54% of men admit to viewing pornography in a one-month period. Whilst men make up 75% of those addicted to pornography, Spencer says women are now the fastest growing group, and children too are also becoming victims of this addiction. To find out more about a social and moral problem that is little talked about, even within the church, I contacted Spencer, who told me why he is so concerned about the prevalence of pornography in today's society.
Well, my overall concern is because it is such a huge destroyer of individual lives, family life, and even our culture. But as I traveled around the country meeting with various men's groups, I found that pornography was one of those recurring problems that seemed to be cropping up more and more in men's lives.
How would you describe this addiction, and roughly what sort of figures are we talking about?
Well, the addiction can run anywhere from just it's not always addiction. It's all the way from just an attraction to things like pornography, all the way up to full-blown addiction. And not everyone is fully addicted, of course, but statistics tell us that about 1 in 10 adults truly have a sexual addiction, which is an enormous number. And in my kind of non-scientific discoveries, as much as 30 to 50% of the men in the conference have and struggle with some sort of porn-related issues.
And what about women? Do women also have an attraction or an addiction to pornographic material?
Well, unfortunately, I'm sorry to relate that while just as recently as three or four years ago, the amount of usage of pornography by women was around 7% of women. Today, that number has climbed to 28%. So it's probably the fastest growing group, and that has occurred for a lot of reasons, but it seems that those social norms are falling even further. And so, as I said, almost over a quarter of pornography use is now by women.
And is it growing very rapidly? And if so, is that largely because of the ready availability and the anonymity on the internet?
It is indeed. One of the traditional social barriers, of course, to any pornographic material historically has been one had to go down the street and go to a place that purveyed that sort of thing, or had to go out in public and purchase a magazine or a video. And with the introduction of the internet, all of that terrible content is brought right to your home so that it's right available for any person, whether they be a child or an adult, to access that. And it's being pushed to us on the internet pretty consistently.
Now, what percentage of this pornographic material involves children, i.e. is a pedophile porn?
I don't have a real hard specific percentage of the percentage of pornography that deals with it, but I know that in an average hour, over $250,000 is spent on pornography, and about two videos are made every hour around the globe, somewhere around the globe, and many of those are increasingly children. In fact, children are the number one target of pornographers because they know if they hook them early enough that it will evolve into that addiction, and that way they have what they would consider a lifetime customer. And that's very disturbing. The average age that children encounter pornography has dropped from 14 years old to about 8.5 years old today.
What kind of effects is it having on the men themselves, their families, their work, and society at large?
Well, it's difficult to express all the ways in which it affects them. First of all, of course, it's a very degrading, shameful activities and kind of the way these things are worked out. And so there's a lot of hidden lives, that double lives that are created, which of course breeds distrust in marriages. Children are affected by this. If they realize that parents have had this sort of addiction, it is the result sometimes of broken families. So it's really a codification of what Paul VI said would happen if we got into this overly sexualized culture in Humanae Vitae, where women are really seen as purely objects, sexual objects. It's very prophetic in that sense. It's really coming to reality that we have degraded women primarily in this thing.
You touched there on possibly some of the causes, but of course, my next question is, what is causing this? Is it, as you say, we live in times where sex is all around us or sexual image all around us. What is causing this growth in addiction and viewing of pornographic images?
Well, there's several key foundational things that are going on. One of those is we have increasingly high numbers of dysfunctional families where abandonment, either not necessarily physical abandonment, but sometimes emotional abandonment when parents are very involved in their professions and their work and their children are left to their own time, and then it gives them access to this information. There's lots of family wounds, whether those are sexual in nature or just interpersonal wounds. So families are really hurting in these days, and this seems to attack at that time. We have, as you said, a very highly sexualized culture that denies kind of the dignity of each person's sexuality, the decoupling of sexuality from love, and kind of the desensitization of, you know, perversion seems possible and permissible now. And then, of course, the internet has changed everything because it's removed all the social barriers and financial barriers, and it's an always-on access. So there's lots of foundational reasons for this. And then, of course, once one is addicted, truly, it becomes a whole cycle of kind of shame. And we just don't talk about this subject very much. And hence, it's very difficult to be healed without an intervention from the church and others.
Prompted you as a Catholic, you know, a practicing Catholic, to get interested and involved in this issue of addiction to pornography and to try to combat it?
Well, the first question most people ask is, am I a former pornography addict myself? And I am not. But as I said, I meet with men around both here locally and around the country every single week. And as I increasingly hear about the challenges they face, this issue kept rising to the top. And it's not one they're proud of. It's not one they can talk to many about. So as I encounter them, I just realized that we really needed some initiatives to deal directly with this for the sake of those men who I was working with, for their spouses who are just very torn up in their families, their jobs, their lives.
What are some of the kinds of issues these men have been battling with?
Well, many of these men, for instance, will forego doing their daily work and find themselves spending hours and hours online on pornography, and they find themselves out of work. Numbers of these men have lost their professional careers.
And how easy is it to wean these men off their addiction?
For those that are truly addicted, it is much more difficult, but we have a very good process that usually if men will enter into our recovery groups, in a couple of years they can get on top of this and begin feeling real victory. But it takes real serious work of peer support groups, not unlike AA, but with much more of a Catholic emphasis of the sacraments and peer-to-peer support and daily phone calls, etc. For those who are just attracted to this, if they really enter into some preventive activities, and that's some of the things that we share as well, for instance, having the computer in a public area so your children are not in their rooms, putting software on a computer that prevents access to most pornographic sites, to discussing this with children, to establish theology of the body classes within each parish or each diocese. These are preventive issues that keep men, women, and children from beginning this terrible activity. And so it's not just fixing those for whom are wounded, but also preventing those from ever beginning into this cycle.
And tell us something about this anti-pornography initiative called My House that opened in the U.S. state of Kansas.
Well, this actually was started by our Archbishop, who also recognized this issue. He is Archbishop Joseph Naumann. And it was part of our discussions with him about these men's issues. I think it was about 4 years ago we initiated this process. And its goal was really to help families to understand what true virtue of chastity meant. And we wanted to build awareness about pornography and then to help and heal those who'd been harmed by it and, of course, to educate people. So we actually initiated a very very aggressive program here in Kansas City, Kansas. We had a video from the Archbishop that was shown in every Mass on a given Sunday. We had plenty of advance so that small children would not be there. We formed parish-based groups, anonymous groups where men and or women could attend. We had set up a spousal support system for primarily the women of men who were addicted. We started a women's group. We started prayer groups.
And is there more that you would like to see the Catholic Church doing to combat this problem?
Some of us, as I said, are very involved with lay ministry, both locally and around the country. And so I would encourage every bishop to take this seriously. It is not just another activity. They just need to see the ramifications for this horrifying sexual tsunami that is destroying families and individuals and the culture. And indeed, it's attacking our church with the various crises, and we just need to open the windows, as Vatican II said, and discuss these issues openly and to get help to people who are struggling.
Right, you talked there about which is affecting the church, and as you well know, of course, the clerical sex abuse crisis has been battering the church in these recent months. And some figures within the church have suggested that in today's over-sexualized society, where it's only too easy to see pornographic videos and images online, that this is perhaps encouraging men, even those among the priesthood, to sexually abuse the young and vulnerable. Would you believe there's any such truth to that, or do you think that's overplayed, given that a lot of these abuse incidents did date back several decades?
I think the foundational problems surrounding some of the priest issues, the pedophilia, are just simply part of our fallen culture going back historically, and I think that the church has actually done a much better job in helping all of us deal with our sexuality, all the way from Paul VI speaking in Humanae Vitae, all the way up through the various encyclicals and teachings and theology of the body, etc. So, but I think for younger, newer priests, that this is certainly part of that sexualized culture that they're not immune from.
Now, do you think this a problem of addiction to pornography is likely to get worse? Do you fear it'll get worse unless aggressive preventative action is taken and more people don't speak up about it?
I know it will get worse because I see it getting worse. As I cited earlier, women who historically have just completely been able to avoid this issue due to the sexualization of the culture now feel more and more acceptant of these kinds of materials. And I think the other growth with technologies that will allow for this are increasing. For instance, there's been a rash of stories about so-called sexting, the sexual image texting by young people. I visited a parish or a diocese recently where the FBI showed up at the diocesan offices with warrants for 3 11-year-old boys who had been taking pictures of 9-year-old girls and sending those by email. So yes, I think it's expanding, and I think as the culture rejects traditional Catholic values, that will continue, and we need to protect our own families and our church, but also do what we can for the culture at large.
I was speaking to Dan Spencer, a U.S. Catholic speaker who campaigns against addiction to pornography. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Hodges. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so do send us an email. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.